Welcome to a very special edition of the Original Jurisdiction Podcast. I'm your host, David Latt, author of a Substack newsletter about law and the legal profession, also named Original Jurisdiction, which you can read and subscribe to at davidlatt.substack.com. You're listening to the 41st episode of this podcast, recorded on Wednesday, March 13. Thanks to this podcast's sponsor, NextFirm. NextFirm helps big law attorneys become founding partners. To learn more about how NextFirm can help you launch your firm, call 212-292-1000 or email careerdevelopment@nextfirm.com. Want to know who the guest will be for the next Original Jurisdiction podcast? Follow NextFirm on LinkedIn for a preview. Today's guest needs no introduction. I'm pleased to be joined by Chris Christie, former U.S. Attorney for the District of New Jersey from 2002 to 2008, the 55th governor of the state of New Jersey from 2010 to 2018, and until his January withdrawal from the race, a contender for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. He's also the author of a new book, What Would Reagan Do? Life Lessons from the Last Great President, which I enjoyed reading and commend to you. Like many national political figures, Governor Christie induces strong reactions. As some of you may know, he and I have a personal connection. My last legal job before entering blogging and journalism was working for then U.S. Attorney Christie in the U.S. Attorney's Office for New Jersey. While working as a federal prosecutor, I wrote a pseudonymous, cheeky blog about the federal judiciary called Underneath Their Robes: News, Gossip, and Colorful Commentary about the Federal Judiciary. In November 2005, I revealed myself as the author of Underneath Their Robes in an interview with The New Yorker, and it turned into a bit of a scandal, since I was appearing before judges by day and writing irreverent, occasionally snarky things about them by night. Chris would have been well within his rights to fire me, and when we met to discuss my continued employment, I offered to resign. But he generously offered to give me a second chance, which I gratefully accepted. A few weeks later, I realized that I actually did want to transition from practicing law to writing about it, and I left the U.S. Attorney's Office. But I'll always appreciate Chris's kindness in letting me leave the law on my own terms and timetable. In this podcast episode, we cover a lot of ground. We discuss Chris's childhood here in New Jersey, his advice on navigating law school, his tenure as U.S. attorney, including some critical commentary about his successors, his three biggest legal cases, his three biggest regrets, hint, supporting Donald Trump is one of them, whom he might vote for in the 2024 presidential election, hint, not Donald Trump, and what's next for him professionally. And for the New Jerseyans among you, we talk about Sammy's Steakhouse in Mendham, a Garden State institution. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Governor Chris Christie. Governor, thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be back with you, David.
So before we dive in, I'd like to thank you for something from years ago, almost 20 years ago. Specifically, you're not firing me in the wake of the Underneath Their Robes controversy. I appreciate your letting me make the transition from practicing law to writing about it on my own terms, which I eventually did later.
Well, David, I hired you because you were and are an extraordinary lawyer and an extraordinary talent. And I hired you when you were quite young, much younger, as you know, than most of the AUSAs were in the office. And my feeling always was that people who are younger will tend to make some errors in judgment. And I came to the conclusion with yours that it was based upon your need to be creative. And it's one of the reasons I hired you in the first place. And I just said to the rest of the team, I'm not going to fire a guy for doing something that comes incredibly naturally to him. And my guess is that he'll find a way to express that in a full-time way. And for the meantime, he's going to provide great value to the people of the United States doing what he's doing. And so not only have I never had any regret about that decision, I take a great deal of pride in our relationship.
Well, thank you so much, Governor. I really, really appreciate that. So let's start at the beginning and with something we share in common, namely New Jersey roots. I believe you grew up quite close to where I live now with my family. You grew up in Livingston?
I sure did.
And what were your childhood and upbringing like?
Well, I was born in Newark, and I lived in Newark until I was 5 years old, which was right around the time that the Newark riots happened. Mm. And my parents, who were both lifetime Newarkers, reluctantly left Newark during that time, as many families did, and moved to Livingston. And it turned out to be a great decision for me and my brother and sister. It was a great place to grow up. We played sports. We went to great public schools there. I would still say that I'm probably good friends with 25 or 30 of my high school classmates. They've all worked on campaigns that I've been involved in and volunteered for me and helped to raise money for me. And it was a wonderful upbringing in a place like Livingston where we were encouraged to achieve. We were given the tools we needed to accomplish those things if we were willing to work hard enough. And my dad, who will be 91 years old next month, still lives in Livingston. So,
that's great.
Obviously held a lot of meaning for him as well.
So I'm not surprised you keep in touch with a lot of your high school friends, because I believe you were president of your high school class.
I was. I was president of my class for all 4 years of high school, 9th through 12th grade, and always enjoyed leading and trying to get things done for the greater good, for a bigger group of people than just for myself. And yes, my classmates honored me with 4 straight wins there, which was a lot of fun, and gave me an opportunity to also speak at our high school graduation, which is a memory that I hold dear, even though, David, that this spring, that event will have happened 44 years ago.
Oh, so, wow.
You know, time marches on.
And you also were involved in student government at the University of Delaware, right?
I was. I became the president of the student body at the University of Delaware as well. And that's where I met my wife. She was also involved in student government, a year younger than me. And that's where we met. And so we've been together now. We met back in 1981. Didn't start to date until 1984. Wound up getting married in 1986. And just last week celebrated our 38th wedding anniversary.
Oh, wow. Happy anniversary. That's great.
Thank you.
And you and Mary Pat still live in New Jersey, right?
We do. We still live where we lived when I was U.S. attorney. The exact same house. We moved in there in 1999 in Mendham, New Jersey. And we still live there, and the home where we raised our children. We also now have another house in Bayhead, New Jersey, at the Jersey Shore, which we purchased after I left the governorship. And so we are 2 deep in New Jersey now, David, 2 homes deep. So we're not going anywhere anytime soon.
So my husband, Zach, who grew up in Mendham, told me to ask you if you're still a regular at Sammy's.
Sure. Well, look, Sammy's is one of the great lesser known places in North Jersey. It is literally, if you go down Mendham Road in Mendham, you leave the kind of commercial area and across from the firehouse, there is a little ranch house, no sign, no advertisement, little parking lot around it. And that is Sammy's old cider mill. And what it was back in the day was a speakeasy during Prohibition. That's how it opened. And if you go in there, David, which I suggest if you haven't been, that you should, the cider mill is right across the street. And it was an operating cider mill for decades. And the bar is in the basement of this house. So you go in and there's this restaurant on the first floor. But for Prohibition times, if you went into the basement, that's where you could get the illegal booze. And to this day, the way Sammy's operates is you walk in the front door, you order your dinner at the front desk before you sit down. The menu's up there. You order your dinner. You go downstairs to the bar where they have a big old-fashioned bar with some pinball machines and bumper pool table. And then all of a sudden, you'll hear the bartender yell your name out. And that means it's time for you to go upstairs and have your dinner. So, yeah, Sammy's is one of those places that has been a mainstay in that kind of the Mendham, Morristown area. But if you go much out beyond it, there'd be no way for you to know about it. They don't advertise. They don't have a sign. You got to know. So they're very loyal to their speakeasy roots.
Oh, that's great. Well, Zach and I will have to make a point of heading over there from Summit.
You make sure you tell Zach that he owes you one. He's got to take And by the way, I will tell you, make sure you have the vodka pasta.
Okay.
It's one of the best vodka sauces I've ever tasted.
Oh, great. And here in New Jersey, we have a strong Italian community. So penne alla vodka or any pasta alla vodka, there's a high standard.
There's a high standard. Absolutely.
So turning to your career, were there any hints or indications that you might become a lawyer? I believe your parents were not lawyers.
No, my mom never went to college. My mom was the oldest daughter in a single mother home, and they were quite poor. And so my mom went to work very soon after she left high school, graduated from Westside High School, which is now Shabazz High School in Newark. And she worked her entire life in different secretarial roles. And ultimately, her final job was to run the Livingston Public Schools enrollment program. So when new families would come to town, she was the woman they would go to see. And so she got to become kind of the face of the school system for new families. My dad, his father died when he was 16 years old. And again, that put the family in really horrible financial conditions back in those days, because we're talking about now 1949 when that happened. And my dad graduated from high school, got drafted into the Korean War, went off to do his military service. When he came back, he got a job at the Breyers ice cream plant in Newark.
Huh.
And was working on the line making Breyers ice cream. And it was a gentleman that he met there who said to him, you know, you're too smart to do this. My father, before he had gotten drafted, was admitted to Columbia to go to school, but couldn't go because he didn't have the money. And so he said, well, we don't have the money. And he said, well, you're a veteran. You can go on the GI Bill. My father didn't even know that.
Wow.
So my father started going to Rutgers in Newark at night. So he'd work during the day at the Breyers ice cream plant, and it took him 6 years at night, but he got his degree in accounting and became a CPA and spent the rest of his career being a CPA. So there was no hit in my family background. There had never been any lawyers in either side of the family, but I had always taken an interest in the law and always taken an interest in trial law in particular. And so in my own mind, that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a trial lawyer. And I pretty much knew that from the time I was in junior high school, 13 or 14 years old, I knew I wanted to go to law school. And so that's what I did.
So what exposure did you have? If your dad was a CPA and your mother wasn't a lawyer either, was it Perry Mason? Was it classmates, parents? How did you know about the law?
It was classmates, parents. It's a really good observation on your part. I had a number of my classmates whose dads were lawyers. One of them was the municipal judge in town. Hmm. And so I got exposed to them a lot, and I loved the stories they had to tell about their work. It sounded challenging and exciting and to me. And so that's where I really got the exposure. It was from other parents who really, they were the guys that I played sports with through my youth. A number of their dads were lawyers, and that's how, you know, doing sleepovers at their houses and parties and other events, you would hear their fathers tell their stories about being a lawyer. And it sounded like it was right up my alley.
And then you went to Seton Hall for law school. What was your law school experience like? Did you enjoy it?
It was rough in the beginning, I have to tell you. I think I went into it with the wrong attitude, David, and I tell young people getting ready to go to law school about this all the time. I treated it like super senior year when I first got there and was not as focused as I should have been in my first semester and didn't do all that well. Mm. I mean, I didn't come close to failing out, but I didn't get the grades that I was used to getting. And you know, in law school, like there are so few opportunities for you to set your GPA that if you start off badly, you're digging out of a hole for a long time. And so the beginning of it was a little bit rough, but after my first semester, I really began to tackle law school like it was a job and not like it was school. I committed myself to putting in, you know, 8 to 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, between class and outside of classwork. And once I started to do that, my grades went really well. And I enjoyed it more as a result, because I was spending more time getting prepared, understood things more. And so I have a niece who is now at Georgetown Law School. She's a 1L at Georgetown. And I've told her that she has to treat it like a job. And if you treat it like a job, you're going to do well. Her first semester went really, really well from a grade perspective. And she's going to do a circuit court internship this summer. And so she's on the path, I think, to doing some really great things. So my law school period started off rough, but it got better once I got focused on actually doing the work like a professional and not acting like I was still a college kid.
That's great advice, I think. Treating it like a job, you don't need to burn out or spend 24/7 on it. But if you're just disciplined and focused, I think that's great advice. So what was your first job out of law school?
My first job out of law school, I went to a law firm named Doogie & Hewitt in Cranford, New Jersey. And they were a boutique firm of trial lawyers. And all they did was try cases. And most of their work was defending physicians in medical malpractice cases. I had interned in a summer, clerked in a summer for a plaintiff's malpractice lawyer and had actually gone to trial with him, sat at counsel table on a big trial that he had in the summer of my second year of law school. And the adversary counsel was Russ Hewitt from Doogie and Hewitt. And at the end of the trial, which the plaintiffs won, we won the trial, he came up to me afterwards, and he's a very friendly guy and had talked to me a lot during the trial, during off times in the trial. He came up to me and handed me his business card. And he said, if you ever want to come and work for the good guys, give me a call. So right at the end of the summer, I sent him a resume and they called me in for an interview right away and offered me a job. I was married. I'd been married at that time for about a year and a half. And Mary Pat was working as a clerk on a trading desk at DLJ in New York, making about $20,000 a year. And I was working part-time at night in a law firm that probably made me about $10,000 a year at that time. So we needed to go make some money. And so they offered me a job and I took it and I wound up staying there for 14 years. I loved the work. I had my first trial inside my first year as a lawyer. And they kept working me from there and getting me chances to be in the courtroom. And I became a partner after 5 years there. And then my last 9 years, I was doing that type of work, moved away from the malpractice work a little bit to more of the corporate and securities practice that they had, which was a lot of interaction with the SEC. And did that and did some appellate work as well. Did some writing of appellate briefs and editing of appellate briefs and then arguing in appellate court, mostly state court in New Jersey. And I did that right up until the time that I was nominated by President Bush on September 10th, 2001, to be U.S. attorney.
That's really interesting. You had a pretty wide-ranging practice, but it was focused on litigation, though. When you say securities work, you were doing the litigation or dealing with the SEC investigations, what have you?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And civil litigation with the SEC and then some criminal investigations. But usually when they turn to criminal, they would bring in another lawyer from another firm who had criminal defense experience. So if an investigation on the civil side morphed into the criminal, I usually backed away from it, handled just the civil side, and the criminal side was handled by a more experienced lawyer.
So that's actually a good segue to what I wanted to ask you next. When you took over as U.S. attorney, you had extensive trial experience, but you didn't have much experience in criminal law, it sounds like.
Zero.
Zero. Okay. And you mentioned that your practice was primarily in state rather than federal court. So were you nervous when you took over?
Sure. You worked for me, David. So I think I was always and still am an interesting combination of self-confident, but also cautious. And I think that's the way I walked into the job. And I knew that, and you remember the atmosphere in that office, there were a lot of long-time AUSAs who had been there. Many of them were very skeptical when I got the job about whether I was up to it or not. I was young too. When I got to the job in January of 2002, I was just 39 years old. And so I was very young for a U.S. attorney. And I knew I had to go in there and earn it. But my view was that I could learn the criminal law, but what they couldn't learn was how to manage someplace. Mm-hmm. And that my strength was going to be in picking other leaders, in motivating those people to get the work done well and quickly so we could do more of it. And that I could learn the other stuff as I came along if I surrounded myself with really good people. So one of the things that I did very early on when I walked in was to select three other really senior AUSAs to be in my front office. You know, Ralph Mara, who had been at the U.S. Attorney's Office for over 20 years when I made him the first assistant. Charlie McKenna, who had been at the office for over a dozen years by the time I made him executive assistant. And Paula Dow, who had worked both in the Southern District of New York and in New Jersey during most of her career as a criminal prosecutor. So I felt very confident that the things I didn't know they would, that they'd helped to teach me. And so, you know, I remember coming home after my third day at the office and I was exhausted. I got home at about 10 o'clock and I flopped down on the couch and Mary Pat said to me, how's it going? And I said, I'm going to be really good at this job, but I'm the only one who knows it. I said, everybody else is skeptical and I've got to really try to work to win them over. But I said, but I know after 3 days, I was like, I can do this. And I think that the tenure that we spent there, 7 years, and the things that we accomplished during that time and the people that we hired are all things that I'm really proud of.
I totally agree with you about the management point. I think you were a really great manager. Morale was high in the office. You did some restructuring, I recall. But I also just remember you had that sort of people touch. I was actually on the podcast recently of a fellow former U.S. attorney, Preet Bharara, and he asked me, tell me something about Chris Christie that I don't know. And I said, Chris would go to pretty much every farewell party for an AUSA that he could, and he would deliver these really personalized remarks, sometimes poking fun at the person. But you really got to know all 130-something AUSAs.
I really thought that was one of the most important parts of my job, David. And, you know, I used to walk around the office at night, in part to motivate people to let them know I was watching who was working late and who wasn't. But also, it was a time when people were generally more relaxed and not being interrupted by agents or calls from adversaries. And I could sit down and have longer conversations with them and really get to know them. And I thought that was part of the job for me, was to really get to know people. Because then, when a big case comes in, you have a much better idea of who are the right people to handle something that was really sensitive, difficult, important to the office. And I felt like I'd be in a much better position to make those judgments and to pick supervisors. And you know how important that is, because the AUSA, the line AUSA, is generally not going to interact with me all that much, but they will react with their line supervisor every day. And so picking the right kind of people, and I didn't always do it right. There were some clunkers I picked in there that I had to move on to something else. You know, you always promoted them to senior litigation counsel when they didn't work as a unit chief or a division chief. But I'm proud of most of the choices that I made. And I think when you look at the last 20 years of the office never did more cases than they did during the years that I was U.S. attorney. In fact, my successor, the numbers went precipitously down, declined by more than a third on the number of either pleas or convictions that they got per year. And it started to inch back up again under Craig Carpenito, started to go back down again now under Philip Seligman. But I think that's totally driven by the U.S. attorney. If the U.S. attorney lets people know it is a priority for us not to just do some justice, but to do as much justice as we possibly can fairly, I think people dig in and love to do that. But if they think they can just get by doing, you know, at a kind of, you know, country club pace, then people are human. And not all of them will do that, but a lot of them will. And I think that's what you've seen over time. I also tried to bring a real focus to what kind of work we really cared about. Obviously, we were in the media post 9/11 period, so there was a lot of focus on terrorism. But obviously, we focused on political corruption a great deal, and we focused on violent crime, on street crime a lot as well. So that's the kind of leadership that I think U.S. attorney needs to bring and should bring, and where you can have the greatest impact as the leader of the office, as opposed to, you know, one time I actually went, and this will mortify you, I actually went to do legal research myself, and my assistant, Nancy Mantega, dimed me out to Charlie McKenna, and Charlie came and found me down in the 7th floor library with me doing research on the Civil Rights Act. Something that I wanted to do that justice was telling me I couldn't. So I said, well, I'm going to go down there and figure out how I can make the argument to them. And Charlie said, what are you doing? Research. And I said, I'm a lawyer. I know how to do this. And he goes, I'm sure you do, because there's 130 people here who would be like overjoyed to get this directly from you. Why don't we do that? And I said, well, because I want to do it. I'm a lawyer. I want to do that. And Charlie gave me some of the best advice as a manager that I ever got. In terms of the question he asked me then, he said to me, okay, I understand you're a lawyer, you want to do this. But he said, Chris, let me ask you a question. Who's doing what only you can do while you're doing this? Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, David, that that question stayed with me for the rest of my time as U.S. attorney and for my entire career as governor. When you're governor, you can do anything you want. And I always used to ask myself the question, is the time I'm spending doing this exercising the responsibility and the authority of my office that only I can do, or am I off on a frolicking detour? Mm-hmm. And Charlie gave me great advice that day, and it's something that I've kept with me for the rest of my career.
Charlie's a very wise man. He was the head of the intern program when I summered in the office after my 1L year, and he was somebody I turned to for counsel during the whole underneath the robes thing.
And he's a big advocate for you, by the way, with me.
I'm so grateful to Charlie. We still keep in touch, and he writes the Substack newsletter too. But looking back over your legal career, so not yet in your politics career, is there a case or matter of which you're most proud?
There's a number of them. I would say I could narrow it down in the 7 years of the U.S. Attorney's Office to three of them.
Okay.
I would say the Fort Dix 6 case, I'm very proud of. These were people who were plotting an attack on Fort Dix to kill American soldiers. They were Islamic extremists, and we were able with the FBI to infiltrate them through some cooperation that we had developed as an office with the Muslim community in the aftermath of 9/11. And we, I think, acquitted ourselves incredibly well in that case and prevented what would have been a horrific terrorist attack. Second, I'd say it's one that maybe not a lot of people know, but it's the Huntington Life Sciences case. Huntington Life Sciences is one of the companies that did medical research using animals. And there was a group called SHAC, Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, who wound up becoming domestic terrorists. Anybody who got involved with Huntington Life Sciences in any way, the banks where they had their bank accounts, anybody who got involved in any way with them would be attacked. Their homes would be attacked. They would vandalize their homes, break windows and put garden hoses in people's homes and fill their homes with water. I mean, threaten people physically. And three other offices, Southern District of New York, Brooklyn, and Philadelphia, all turned down the case because they said it was just too difficult. And Charlie McKenna came to me with the case and said, I really think this is something we need to do. I think we're going to be focusing on international terrorism. We have to look at domestic terrorism also. And if you're willing to take it, I'll take the lead. And so I came, we met with the victims, and I decided to take the case. And Charlie tried the case down in Trenton in front of Judge Ann Thompson. And we secured convictions and sent some of these folks to more than 10 years in jail for their conduct. And it was one of those where to this day, I will still meet people, David, who were victimized by SHAC and will come up and thank me. And we did that case 18 years ago. And third, I would say it's the Charlie Kushner case, because I think what we showed in that case was no matter how rich you are, no matter how powerful you are, that if you do things that are illegal, and in his instance, beyond any interpretation of appropriate morality, that the office was going to dig in and hold you responsible. And I felt the ramifications for doing that case in my political career for years since then. But I'm incredibly proud of it, because what it showed was the office could do that type of case, wasn't afraid to do it, and would hold everybody, regardless of their status in this country, financial or otherwise, to account. And so I'd say those three cases are the three that I'm most proud of.
Have you ever considered strategically transitioning your practice to a firm of your own? When the 8 founders of Redwood Public Law considered this path for their innovative, market-leading practice counseling cities and other local agencies in California, NextFirm was there to help. In just a few months, it all came together. And now, just a few days old, Redwood Public Law has the platform, the talent, and the agency they need to delight clients and take their practice to new heights in a way they could not before. Maybe NextFirm could help you too. So, you alluded to the complications when you joined the Trump administration and you kind of butted heads with Jared, but it sounds like you have no regrets on the Kushner case.
If I had to do it all over again, I'd do it again, and I'd do it exactly the same way. And what I remind everybody is that Charlie Kushner pled guilty to the entire criminal complaint. This was not where he got railroaded by some aggressive prosecutor and a compliant jury. He pled guilty to every count of the criminal complaint. And so he knew he was guilty. And, you know, the fact is that, yes, it prevented me really from wanting to join the Trump administration, because it became very clear to me in the later stages of the Trump for President campaign. And I remember I was chairman of the transition during the early stages of the transition, that Jared was going to use his position as Donald's son-in-law to try to make life really difficult for me. And as you know, these jobs are difficult enough without having the son-in-law of the president of the United States, married to his favorite daughter, gunning for you every day. So I never joined the Trump administration, in part because of that. In part, it was also my disagreements with his management style and how he worked with people. But I have no second thoughts about it at all, David. Knowing everything I know today, if the same set of facts presented themselves and I was in the U.S. attorney's position, I would do the case exactly the way we did it.
So looking back over your entire career, including your time in politics as well as law, what do you view as your greatest achievement or accomplishment?
I've always said to people that my favorite job was being U.S. attorney.
Huh.
And that's not to degrade being governor. I loved being governor too. I'm very lucky. I've had two of the most amazing jobs that anybody could have ever asked for. So we'll start with saying that U.S. attorney was still my favorite job. But I think with governor, the only thing I could really point to in an undisputed way was the preparation for a reaction and recovery to Hurricane Sandy. Mm. You know, that was the second most devastating natural disaster in the history of the country. Only Katrina was more devastating than Sandy. And there is no manual, David, for how to deal with that after it happens. There's no way you can be prepared for that as a leader. You know, 2/3 of the state was without power. Every major highway obstructed. No operating water treatment or wastewater treatment plants. Every school in the state closed. The nuclear power plant at Oyster Creek in danger of melting down and having to make decisions about whether to pump bay water into the reactor to keep it cool, knowing that you'd have to recirculate it back into the bay, which would cause damage to that. I mean, choices that were unthinkable to me when I became governor, that I was making on a daily basis. And the way we reacted to it, the way we prepared for it, we had a very minimal loss of life because we evacuated people from the dangerous areas aggressively and quickly before the storm and didn't make it optional. And the recovery, when you go back now, 10 years later, 11 years later to the Jersey Shore, it's recovered. It's rebuilt. You see no remnants left of the damage from Sandy. And, you know, I think most people thought the Jersey Shore might not come back, that people would not build homes again on the beach, that businesses wouldn't recover. Yet if you go back there now, it is recovered. And there's lots of things in the governorship that I'm proud of, but nothing that comes close to the challenge that that was and the gratification that me and the folks in our administration felt for being able to help people who had lost everything in their life and needed to start back again from ground zero.
That actually ties into a question I wanted to ask you. Hurricane Sandy was in the fall of 2012, I believe. Do you regret not running for president in 2012? I guess that would not have had you around for your leadership during Hurricane Sandy, but do you regret that when you were a wildly popular governor of a blue state? A lot of people have said, oh, if Christie had run then, he might have won.
Yeah, well, all those people are armchair geniuses, David. You know those. And look, no, I don't have any regrets about it. And here's why. I wasn't ready to be president. I had been governor for about 18 months or so when I would have had made the decision to run, which would have been, you know, sometime in the late summer of 2011. And I just was convinced I wasn't ready. Now, I know that given some of the presidents we've had since then, that the idea of being ready is a quaint, antique type of concept. But at the time, it wasn't to me. And so, no, I don't have any regrets. And imagine, and I thought about this a number of times, for the people who say I definitely would have won. Imagine that was the last 8 days of the presidential campaign when Sandy hit. I still would have been governor. So imagine, what do I do? Let's say I'm in the last 8 days of a really competitive presidential campaign against the incumbent president, by the way, which people also forget. We don't turn out incumbents very easily in this country. And the first African-American president, which I think made him even more formidable. But what would I have done? Do I leave the campaign trail and go back and do my job? Is that a way of campaigning? How many people in all the other 49 states who weren't going to see me for the last 8 days of the campaign? I wasn't coming in to campaign for their electoral votes. I wasn't coming in to campaign for their down ticket candidates. How would they have reacted to all that? So I sometimes think that God directs you in a way that you need to go, even if you don't quite understand what the reasons are. And I think I prayed a lot over the decision whether to run or not in 2011. It was purely my decision. Ultimately, there was a lot of disagreement inside my camp. A lot of my political advisors wanted me to run. And ultimately, I didn't feel ready and it didn't feel right to me. And I've often wondered whether I was directed in that way because he had something different in mind for me.
So things did work out for the best in a way. So let me ask you this. You don't seem big on second thoughts, but you don't regret the Kushner case. You don't regret not running for president. What would you say is the greatest regret of your professional life? Besides supporting Trump, that would probably be up there.
Yeah. Supporting Trump's in the top three for sure. Look, I would say the other two would be Bridgegate and the fact that people on my watch did some things that were so monumentally stupid that it's still hard for me to understand why they did what they did. I think the U.S. Attorney's Office conducted themselves in a completely unethical and unprofessional way in the way they handled it, the way they leaked on it. Ultimately, they brought a case that they couldn't win. They convinced the jury to do it. But, you know, when you get, as you know better than anybody as a student of our Supreme Court, when you get Clarence Thomas and Ruth Bader Ginsburg to agree that something has been done wrongly under the law, you've really screwed up in a major way. And that's what Paul Fishman did. I think it will always be because of personal animus he had towards me and a sense of inferiority that he had as the U.S. attorney who followed me and my record and then me being governor at the same time. And so I don't have any regrets about that. But I do have great regret for the fact that I put people into a position of authority who exercised such poor judgment. And it hurt our ability to do other things in the second term because we were occupied for the first year of the second term with defending that. And that really was a big disappointment. And I'd say the Trump thing would be first if we were putting him in order. I think the Bridgegate thing would be second. And third, it's kind of a micro issue, but it's important to the state. You know, you have public servants, police, fire particularly, who accumulate all of these sick days. Apparently, these men and women never get sick their entire lives when they're in public service. And because the law permits them to cash out those sick days when they leave, not at the salary they earn them, but at the salary they're at when they leave, which is almost always their highest salary. And this ends up in having checks issued to people on departure of $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, sometimes more. And I wanted it to be zero. If you didn't use your sick days, the gift was you weren't sick. Congratulations. But you shouldn't get paid for them. The legislature sent me a bill that would have capped it at $10,000. And I vetoed it because I wanted zero. And it was one of the few times in my governorship that I didn't take a win off the table and go with it, even if it wasn't exactly what I wanted. I got stubborn about it, probably a little bit of hubris involved too, because I thought I was right on the issue and I'd be able to convince them to send me the zero bill. And I should have signed it because it has cost taxpayers since that day, right up till today, where it still is the law, tens of millions of dollars in taxpayer funds that otherwise wouldn't have been spent. So that one is one that's a little bit in the weeds, but I think about it often when I read in the paper about another $350,000 or $400,000 check going to a retired police officer or firefighter. I think they're entitled to get everything they get in their pensions. But to get a check like that on the way out just because you didn't use your sick time seemed to me to be, you know, outrageous. I could have capped it at $10,000 and I screwed up. I didn't.
So your point about not compromising actually brings me to another reason I wanted to talk to you, which is your new book, What Would Reagan Do? Life Lessons from the Last Great President. I greatly enjoyed it. And one of the themes you had in the book was just Reagan's willingness to work with the other side and to take that win, even if it's not perfect or has everything. So what inspired you to write this book?
You know, as you might imagine, David, the intractability of today's politics, the unwillingness for people not only not to compromise, but not even to speak to each other. I mean, if you just look at some of the things that happened over the last 48 hours, Ken Buck, Republican conservative congressman, former prosecutor from Colorado, had said he wasn't going to run for re-election because he was so miserable in Congress and said things couldn't get done. Yesterday announced he's resigning a week from Friday.
Wow. Yep.
Because he said it's so miserable and that there's no camaraderie, no sense of spirit for the country, that everything is personal. That's an example of the stuff I've been seeing. and really led me to say, how did Ronald Reagan become a conservative icon, an iconic president, a top 10 president, in my view, in the history of the country, with a divided Congress, never had a Republican House, always worked with Tip O'Neill, who was a clear, real liberal Democratic partisan. And he got Social Security reform done, immigration reform done. At the time, the biggest tax cut in American history through a Democratic House. How did he get all these things done? And I wanted to go back and re-examine it. You know, Reagan was my first vote, as I say right in the book, the first chapter. I think it was the first line of the book. And so I have some personal memory of it, but after 40 years, those memories fade or tend to become convenient. So I wanted to go back and really do the work on figuring out how did he do it and go all the way back to his childhood and say, what was it about Reagan's upbringing, his young career, both on radio and in Hollywood, and then his transformation to General Electric spokesman and how that impacted his philosophy, his head of the Screen Actors Guild and the fight against communism. And how did he deal with that? How did all this stuff shape the president he ultimately became? And so it was really the intractability of today's politics that made me want to go back and look at it.
Many of the qualities and accomplishments of Reagan that you tout in the book, his optimism, his willingness to work with the other side, his strong foreign policy, his immigration reform, they seem so out of step with the Republican Party in 2024. You say Reagan wouldn't recognize the party. I wonder if the party would still recognize and admire Reagan now that it's enthralled to Donald Trump. So I guess my question is, can the party be saved? Can we have a return to the Republican Party of the Reagan era, or is it too far gone?
I think it can be, David, but it takes hard work. And the problem with the leaders in our party right now is they're unwilling to do the hard work. Behind the scenes, they'll all say the same thing to you. He's awful. He's terrible. I can't believe we're here. I can't stand it. But none of them will say it publicly. I mean, think about this, David. The first presidential debate on the Republican side this year, when six of the eight candidates on that stage raised their hands to say they would support Donald Trump, even if he were a convicted felon. I can only imagine that Jefferson and Adams and Washington were spinning in their graves. I've had any number of voters up in New Hampshire who said to me, why isn't it illegal for a felon to run for president? And I said, because Adams and Jefferson and Franklin never thought we'd be that stupid. They thought that would be self-evident. And they are watching right now, very disappointed in the citizens of this country. They would be completely repulsed by Donald Trump. But they are disappointed, I'm confident, in our citizens who are not holding him to account. So I think it's going to be that hard work. And that's what I tried to begin to do during the primary. But I'm not kidding myself that that's something that can be accomplished quickly. And it was clear from my performance in the primary, it wasn't going to be able to be accomplished this year in the Republican Party. But I do think a disruption to the two-party system has to happen. And I am a loyal Republican. I love the party what it used to be, but I understand for the first time what Reagan said in that book I just wrote about the Democratic Party. He was a Democrat. And he said, I didn't leave the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party left me. And I really feel like for a lot of the Republicans, especially the Trump Republicans who are in charge of the Republican Party now, I didn't leave the Republican Party. They're leaving me and leaving a lot of us homeless politically.
So as of this taping, Trump has officially clinched the nomination. So maybe this question's a bit academic, but setting aside yourself and Trump, who among the other contenders for the nomination did you most admire or respect?
Great respect for Asa Hutchinson, because he was also one of the people who would refuse to raise their hand. And I knew Asa as a governor, and I had great respect for Asa. I also have great respect for Tim Scott. Now, Tim is disappointing me right now in how overboard he's going, in my view, in his capitulation to Donald Trump. And I have to tell you that I don't really understand it, given everything I know about the God-fearing, respectful, smart person that Senator Scott is. But he's probably the second one on that stage that I have enormous respect for, not only for the arc of his career, but for the arc of his life. This is a guy who has overcome a lot of challenges, some of whom were foisted upon him, some of whom he foisted upon himself. But I always will have a lot of affection for Tim. I think he's a good leader, and I hope that he doesn't go too far overboard with this Trump stuff, because it will hurt, I think, long-term, his reputation in history.
You've stated in recent interviews that you're definitely not voting for Trump, but you can't see yourself voting for Biden yet. You said you're not there yet. Any updates?
No, I'm still there. I couldn't vote for either one of these clowns.
Okay. And you've urged the Democrats to replace Biden. Could you see yourself voting for a Democrat who's not Biden?
Depends on who it is, right, David? Okay. I would make that judgment based upon the way I judge every candidate, their character, their record, their plans for the future. So I wouldn't completely exclude that possibility. And I wouldn't exclude the possibility that ultimately I could vote for President Biden. But right now, given what he's saying and doing, that budget he just submitted, these are things that from a policy perspective are just, I think, dead wrong for the country. And so that's why I couldn't vote for him right now. Now, look, as I've said to people, I'm also a practical political thinker. My vote in New Jersey, as you know, means very little. Joe Biden's going to win New Jersey no matter what happens. And so it's not as if I feel like my vote will be pivotal in New Jersey's 14 electoral votes. I think those are pretty firmly in Joe Biden's column. But I do think as a leader in our country, I have an obligation to let people know what I intend to do. But right now, all I can tell them is, the only thing I know for sure is I would not vote for Donald Trump under any circumstances. And as for the rest of it, we'll see who No Labels comes up with as a candidate and see what Joe Biden does between now and then, or if the Democratic Party, either by choice or necessity, decides to make some kind of change.
It's interesting you mentioned No Labels. Joe Manchin and Governor Hogan, I believe, have stated that they will not run as presidential contenders for No Labels. You have been floated as a possible third-party candidate for them. Any updates on that front?
No, nothing to update you on. I will say this. I think that the people who have been supporting No Labels are really smart, well-meaning Americans who look at the choice between Joe Biden and Donald Trump and say, we have to be able to do better.
So you're not worried that No Labels is just going to be a spoiler that's going to get Trump elected?
Depends on who they pick.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right? It depends on who they pick. And who does that person take from more? Sure, it's something I'd be concerned about. And I think if someone were clearly going to help Trump, I think that would be contrary to the goal and mission of No Labels. And I hope they wouldn't do that. And I think it would be also the responsibility of the candidate if it evolved into that happening and they were opposed to that, to withdraw themselves. I think the support is so soft among the deciding part of the electorate here. I'd say Trump has somewhere between 38 and 40% right now. I think it could be less. I think Biden is in the same neighborhood, could be less. So it depends on what that candidate comes in and does. Can they, you know, reduce what they have currently? And if they do, who do they take it from? The smart campaign, it seems to me, would be looking to say a pox on both their houses.
Mm-hmm.
We can do better on both sides. But it's an interactive game, right, David? You know, voters get to decide which way they want to go, what they think's viable, what resonates with them the most. So that'd be something that you look at really carefully.
Fair enough. So before we go to my last four questions, my little speed round of standardized questions, my last question is, assuming you don't run on the No Labels ticket, what's next for Chris Christie?
You know, David, I'm taking some time to figure that out. I have a great consulting firm here in Morristown with five other folks who work with me that we enjoy doing and helping people figure out how to interact with government at every level and also give them crisis management and crisis communication advice as well. I opened up just a small law firm with myself and Michelle Brown, who you know, who works with me as well. And we do some advising to folks. Most of the folks have some criminal issues who need some wiser and sager advice than they might get someplace else. I was on a number of boards. I still am on three of them. I dropped out of two of them when I ran for president. So I'll continue to have a presence on boards. One of them is publicly traded. The other two are privately held. And I continue to do paid public speaking to keep my, you know, chops going here and, you know, keep myself current. And I have a contract with ABC and I'm still figuring out when it might be the right time to go back. I don't necessarily want to be a pundit on the primary race. Now that the primary race is over as of last night, then I think I'm more open to be able to go back and continue to do commentary on ABC when I'm not commenting on the entire prior or even a portion of the primary field, but just commenting on what the general election would look like.
We will watch with interest your next move. So here are my final four questions. My first is, what do you like the least about the law? And this can either be the practice of law or law as a more abstract system.
That's easy, David. Billing hours. The most miserable part of any private practice lawyer's practice. I don't care what they tell you. The answer is that it's a pain. It, to me, has nothing to do with the quality of the work that we provide for a client, but it is the way that the profession has evolved. And I will tell you that in my private practice now, I refuse to bill hours.
Oh, okay.
I come up with a monthly retainer for people, and I try to come up with a fair number that they think is fair and agreed to. And I tell people who want to pay me by the hour, I turn the business down. That's how much I hate billing hours, David.
Wow. Okay, great. You're not the first guest to mention that, but I totally understand. My second question is, what would you be if you were not a lawyer? And I would also exclude president.
Look, if I weren't a lawyer, I think that I would probably wind up being involved in Wall Street in some way. I think those skills that I have could be, I think, really well utilized in finance. And that's probably where I would be if I weren't a lawyer. But I'm really glad I am one. And I never had any second thoughts about that choice. But if asked to give a backup, that's probably the backup.
Okay, that makes sense. It's kind of adjacent to what your father did. And I believe your brother was in finance also.
My brother, too, worked on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange for a couple of decades and always has been involved in finance. So that definitely runs in my family much more than being a lawyer or a politician, that's for sure.
Are any of your kids going into law?
None so far. I have three of them who have graduated from college. Now, none of them have expressed any interest in going to law school. Our fourth child, Bridget, is a political science major at Notre Dame, finishing her junior year. So I still think there may be some interest on Bridget's part in pursuing the law, but she's the last chance we have at it. And I've been very low-key about it. I've said to them, I think that deciding to be a lawyer, like any profession, is a very personal decision, and you've got to decide it's something you really feel passionate about. Because if you don't, it'll be miserable.
Yeah.
And I think it's about any job. What I tell my kids all the time is find out what you love to do and then figure out how to make a living at it. Don't do it the other way. And most of the time, if you really care about something or passionate about something, you'll be able to figure out a way to make a nice living at it.
I feel those are words that I've tried to follow in terms of my own transition.
You certainly did.
So my third question is, how much sleep do you get each night?
Not enough, David. I would say I average 5 to 6 hours of sleep a night. I've never been a great sleeper. As I get older, I need it more. So I find it affects me more than I don't sleep enough, but I haven't quite figured out a way yet to stretch that into 7 or 8 hours. And so, you know, I am deficient on the sleep front. And now that I'm 61, I feel it a little bit more than I did when I was 41. When I was 41, it didn't really matter to me much at all. 61 is starting to matter to me a little bit more.
And my last question is, any parting words of wisdom, such as career advice or life advice for my listeners?
I will tell you what I tell my children, which I think is the most sincere advice I could give to anybody, that most of your life you really can't control. Most of your life is subject to things that are outside of your ability to control them. But the two things that you can control every day that will determine a lot of what happens into your life is how hard you work and how you treat other people. And if you treat other people well and work as hard as you can, I got a feeling that your life will be both successful and happy. And I think those are the two things you can control the most. And I would say to anybody out there that ultimately, that's the way you'll be judged. Are you somebody who is willing to put in a really hard day's work, do whatever needed to be done to get the job done that was in front of you? And are you going to treat other people with kindness and fairness and respect and compassion? And hopefully for those who become closest to you, love. And I think if you do all those things, that comes back to you over and over again. And so that's what I tell my kids. And I think that's the best advice that I could give.
This was so much fun. It was great to reconnect after all these years. So thank you, Governor Christie, for joining me.
David, thank you.
Thanks so much to Governor Christie for joining me. As I mentioned, I'll always be grateful for his kindness when I work for him, and I thank him for today's conversation, full of his usual insight and candor. Thanks to NextFirm for sponsoring the Original Jurisdiction podcast. NextFirm has helped many attorneys to leave big law and launch firms of their own. To explore this opportunity, please contact NextFirm at 212-292-1000 or email careerdevelopment@nextfirm.com to learn more. Thanks to Tommy Herron, my sound engineer here at Original Jurisdiction, and thanks to you, my listeners and readers. To connect with me, please email me at davidlatt@substack.com or find me on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at David Latt and on Instagram at David Benjamin Latt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, review, and subscribe. Please subscribe to the Original Jurisdiction newsletter if you don't already over at davidlatt.substack.com. This podcast is free, but it's made possible by paid subscriptions to the newsletter. The next episode should appear 2 weeks from now, on or about Wednesday, April 3. Until then, may your thinking be original and your jurisdiction free of defects.